Good evening. Welcome to this evening's event, which is organized by the Hellenic Observatory at the LSE. My name is Spiros Economides. I'm the Deputy Director of the Hellenic Observatory, and I also teach in the International Relations Department and the European Institute. It gives me great pleasure to welcome all of you here this evening for this event. It also gives me great pleasure to welcome our speaker. Our speaker this evening is Ambassador Yanis Tsarousis, who's the Ambassador of the Hellenic Republic to the Court of St. James, as it's officially known. Prior to taking up this post in London, Ambassador Tsarousis was Director of the Diplomatic Cabinet of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, from 2019 to 2023. In that period, as far as I remember, he had practical experience of what he's going to be talking about this evening. The office of the minister was heavily involved in organizing, of course, the minister's visits and trips. He went around the world how many times, Ambassador? I think you lived your life on a plane, as far as I can recall.
More than 90 countries.
More than 90 countries in those
nine
few
zero,
years.
Nine zero.
So he brings with him a wealth of experience, having served in posts in Cyprus, in South Africa, as well as the permanent representation to NATO and the EU, if I'm not mistaken.
UN.
The UN. So he brings with him a wealth of experience in the practical aspects of diplomacy. Ambassador Tsarousis has studied in this country. He holds an LLM from the University of Kent, and he's also studied at the University of Oxford. Of course, he's got a degree from Greece, and I think he also studied in Paris as well. So he's got a multicultural academic background as well. The theme of today's event is applied diplomacy, setting goals and identifying tools. Now, I don't want to say too much more of this. I'm going to leave that to the ambassador to develop his ideas. Suffice it to say that one of the things that I took away from the initial conversation we had about this evening's event was that foreign policy affects people's daily lives as well as serving national interests. And what I think the ambassador is interested in trying to develop with you tonight is, how do we make this happen? What are the tools that we can use in attempting to set foreign policy goals in a way that affects people and not just the more abstract idea of a national interest? I have to make a few housekeeping announcements before inviting the ambassador to make his presentation. And in fact, tonight's presentation is going to be something different from what we're used to in the academic context. What the ambassador would like to do is present to you 10 problems for which he has identified some tools to achieve certain goals, but he's going to be stopping along the way to invite comments from you and perhaps solicit your ideas on what may be the most appropriate way of taking action in any particular circumstance. And then following that particular part of the event, we will open it up to a broader question and answer session. To those of you who feel the need to tweet, do we say tweet anymore, or do we say to X? For those of you who feel the need to tweet or to X, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Greece. The event is being recorded. It will be hopefully posted as a podcast and YouTube video on the HO's platform, and it's also being live streamed. So if you are going to make any comments, please keep them within the bounds of politeness and whatever else applies to these academic fora. So without any further ado, Ambassador Yanis Tsarousis, welcome to the LSE.
I hope you will do that at the end as well. But you have to contribute to this discussion so that we are going to have together this result. I would like to thank wholeheartedly Dr. Spiros Economides, an old friend of mine, and somebody who has worked, as many others in this room, Kevin Federson, Mr. Ronan Masiotis as well, for bringing closer your prestigious institution with Greece for many years now. And as a representative of the Greek state, I would like to tell you that we very much appreciate what you have done all these years. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss some issues that come out from life, I mean, from professional experience, and not, you know, having a set discussions about just strategic parameters and what is happening now in different parts of the world, but rather to see how concrete problems can be solved through diplomacy. Actually, diplomacy and what we do, as in many other jobs, is sometimes misunderstood. There is always a difference between perception and what we really do. Diplomacy is actually a profession, is a job that sets goals and uses tools in order to achieve the goals. As Professor Economidis said, this is something that often it is neglected. People do not know what we really do. People believe that, we go to receptions where we drink our champagne, and we discuss, generally just strategic issues. But there are times in life, in our professional life, that we have to find tools in order to address particular problems. All this has a framework, of course, and this framework are the goals that each Ministry of Foreign Affairs, each country sets for its foreign policy. And of course, there are many. These goals are you can find them everywhere if you are a professional. In our case, there are in the strategic planning of our strategic plan of our ministry, but also in inside the law, they're contained in the law that governs the function of the ministry itself. And this is likewise in many other countries. And sometimes, the one copies from the other because the goals are more or less the same, the general goals of diplomacy in different countries. I would like to go through, to present to you the 10 goals that are written and included in the law governing the function of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and then discuss particular problems that may arise or situations when you are trying to achieve or to do things that are compatible with these general goals of the ministry and your country, of course. First of all, we have 10 broad strategic, foreign policy goals. First of all is, and these affect also daily life and the people themselves. First of all, promote security and territorial integrity of the country. Contribute to regional and international peace and stability. Number 3, protect human rights. Number 4, upgrade the role of the country to the EU and the international system. Number 5, contribute to the consolidation of international legality. Number 6, promote political and economic interests of the country at the bilateral and multilateral levels. Number 7, promote the culture and civilization of the country abroad. Number 8, promote the rights of nationals abroad and maintain the bonds with their country of origin. This includes some of you as well inside this room, as far as Greece is concerned, but as far as other countries. 9, promote national, economic, trade, maritime, and tourist interests and facilitate the access of businesses to international markets and attract foreign investment. And 10, promote the image of the country abroad through public diplomacy. This is what we have to achieve as professionals, or contribute, but this is what the country has to achieve. And as professional diplomats, we are contributing to that. But sometimes there are issues, that complex issues, that in our daily life, daily professional life, arise, and we have to deal with them. I have, dear Spiros, I have 10 examples of those problems, those situations that might arise, and I would like to discuss them with you. Let's take the first goal, which is promote security and ensure territorial integrity of your own country. Let's think of a situation where a partner or a friendly country sells arms to a third country which threatens your country and undermines its security and territorial integrity. Nothing to do, with Greece, Turkey and other examples. This is something that can happen to everybody. This is something that a situation that the professional diplomat in any country might encounter. And I wanted to ask you, actually, and to have a discussion on what you would envisage that the practical steps that one can take could be in this kind of situation. Of course, this is not a matter of one person. This is a matter of a system, actually, services that are dealing with that. But there is an underlying, you know, practice that you can, and tools, actually, that you can use in order to address this situation. I wanted to, I don't know if I can do that, open the floor to get your ideas. I repeat, country A is a friendly country to your country, which is country B, and this friendly country sells arms to country C, which is a country which threatens you, threatens and your security, and undermines the territorial integrity. What would you do as first steps in order to address this kind of situation? Please. If you are a professional and you have to give an
Can
advice.
You hear me?
Yes.
Could you please just identify yourself? Tell us who you are and what your affiliation is, just so we know.
Oh, my name is Luca Pellegrino, and I'm a student at the LSE, studying History of International Relations. Well, quite easily, as a first step, you could contact the ambassador of country B, which is the one threatening country A, if I'm correct.
Sorry, I cannot hear you.
So the case, it's a country A is being...
You are the ambassador of country B.
I'm the ambassador of country B. Okay, sorry. So
not the ambassador, actually somebody charge in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
So as a
and
first step...
And you need to advise the leadership, the political leadership of the ministry.
Okay. So as a first step, I would contact the ambassador of the country that's giving weapons to this group that's threatening the country. Mm-hmm. If that were not to work, then I would go to an international body of which both countries are part, if this is the case. Mm-hmm. But and if that were not the case, well, I would not know what the second step could be. It's a very complicated.
This is actually what you have to do. I mean, is anybody else, any other idea? We're in the right track. Please.
Good evening. I'm Anastasia from Ukraine, and today is the 700th of dates of our fights. And I think this example of Ukraine is a little bit easier to understand. So in this way, when we have some sanctions, when we have some sanctions, it can be as well second level of sanctions to countries who support countries who are against us. So in this way, in case there are some prosecutions against countries who treat you, maybe there are any chance to have some rules or legal procedures that can as well limit activities of the second country, who is not your enemy, but who support your enemy, as in US we see now against countries who support Russia in their war. Thank you.
This could also be a line to take. But also I mentioned partner country, which means that this country, I mean country B, country A, is working together with you, defending the same principles and goals. And this maybe may cause, a difficulty for you to take sanctions or against this country, because it's a country that you have very good, I should say excellent relations. So this is an issue that you might think to consider in your thinking as well, I mean, this parameter. Please.
Hi, I'm Reda. I'm a student at the Public Policy School at the LSE. I think my first instinct would be to check this information. How is the weapons being sold? are the weapons used against me particularly? What is stopping my adversary from using the weapons that my partners, the countries that look like me, partner with me, from using it against me? Are there any things in these contracts from when they're sold? And then once I have the information, once I have a big picture of what's happening, I need to check whether I can confront the countries that I'm partnering with, whether that specific country or the countries that look like that country, who would be interested to support my case as well. And once that's been done and I know that everyone is backing me, I would confront that country that is selling the weaponry. And if that confrontation doesn't do it's what I hoped it would do, then I would look for other much more aggressive measures to sanction that country, not particularly by my nation, but rather by other partner nations.
Yes. One element is very important that you say. I mean, that at some point you have to start talking to others as well. But maybe in this case, maybe you can do it a little bit later. You have to first, as the first student said, discuss directly to see whether, you know, there is an understanding. And then in this direct discussion, you can get a very reasonable answer that you have already given. I mean, if you are country B, in the sense that you say to them that, you know, they're not going to use it against you. I mean, they are going to use it for other things, for their defense, for their deterrence, for deterrence purposes. I mean, and this is a very reasonable answer, I mean, on their side. So we got two elements there that are very relevant. If I may, I think you have given the answer more or less. If we combine the three answers, I think more or less you can give it. And of course, you have given the answer. And of course, there is not one answer to this. I mean, we're talking about tools. You can use one tool, you can use the other tool. Timing is also very important. The bilateral approach, especially if we are talking about a friendly or a partner country, is very important in the sense that you go and you talk to them. You have a discussion, and then you hear their arguments, and then you see whether you are satisfied with the answer or you still believe that there is a problem. And if you still believe that there is a problem, there are other ways of dealing with this issue. You have implied that. I mean, the last speaker, international organization, second speaker as well, second student, international organizations could be, you know, a resort. But then you escalate, I mean, something that you can solve with other means. Another way of, but you can do it if it is so serious for you. Another way of doing this is to talk to the wider society, to the wider institutions of the country, not only the country B, I mean, not only, you know, the government. For instance, to the parliament, to the political parties, to use public diplomacy means if you feel that the people of this country and the public opinion is friendly to you. Or you can also use think tanks, or even, you know, universities, fora like this one, in order to present your case and put a pressure to the government, a pressure coming from inside, not from outside, to the government that does something that really, really annoys you. Of course, there are other things that you can do. I mean, if you buy arms from them, I mean, you can cancel or delay the procurement of arms if the country A buys from country B. But these are things that you really, in real life, you don't use. You try to find solutions through diplomatic means and discussion, especially if we are talking about partners. You can send, of course, letters directly to them. You can also, in this kind of situation, you avoid, you know, official correspondence like verbal notes, because they are obliged to answer to you, and in this case, you would like to avoid it. And then, you know, you see whether these means can have really achieved something, or you get guarantees. I mean, maybe they can give you guarantees that, as a speaker said before, that they are not going to use it, and they have in their own agreement with this country C, I mean, this kind of clause, that they are not going to be used against any other country belonging to the same partnership or to the same organization, like country B, country A, for instance. So, more or less, this can be, you know, a way out. I mean, these different steps that you can take. I don't know if this is indicative, of course. I mean, there are many other things that you can do or you cannot do. And this applies also to the next goals and the next discussion, the discussion we're going to have on other situation. Now, and of course, and this is what ambassadors usually do, you can take measures in the opposite direction. I mean, trying to create common interests with this country. I mean, make them, you know, have very strong interest in you and your country. I mean, investments in your country, tourism, promote tourism in your country, promote, for instance, other things that can bring these countries together. I mean, defense procurement can also be an element. And this means that, you know, before country B does something that, this is long term, of course, and this is something we are doing continuously, something does that, will do something that affects country A, they will think it twice, because they have interests with country A as well. So, but this is something that you are doing. I mean, you do the immediate steps, you take the immediate steps towards the direction of stopping this, and then you do the other, the positive, let's say, agenda steps, so that this will never happen again. Let's go to the second goal that I have presented to you. Contribute to regional and international peace and stability. Let's imagine another situation now. A situation that, again, some partner and very friendly countries undertake a multilateral initiative regarding a crisis or a conflict in your country's region, proximity, immediate proximity, and they do not invite your country. What do you do? What tools do you think you can use in order to address this kind of situation? Imagine an international conference on a situation which also affects your security, but it's very close to your country, poses problems, you know, migration, energy security, a lot of problems to you, and you're not allowed to discuss it at an international level. Are there any ideas on that? Please. Again, do not think countries, because you are going to have their own.
Hi, sorry. I'm Ted. I'm from the UCL. And it depends. The reason on the reason behind not being invited. If it's because it's a very controversial matter and our position and even appearance there as a nation would stir up the spirits of neighboring nations, that could possibly lead to us getting some concessions or reassurances from allied nations and represent our maybe opinions and expectations in the conference. Or if it's for neither of these reasons and we feel rather cross about it, it would probably lead to a conversation with allied nations on appearing in the next conference, or even reaching out to nations which are not allied with us and not allied with our alliances, and with that kind of courtship, essentially create a scene, diplomatic scene, on that, essentially showing that we want to have this conversation, no matter with who, and if our allies are not ready to have this conversation, then our enemies might be. Thank you.
Anybody else?
You're in the front.
Sorry. Odysseas?
Sorry, Ambassador. Yeah, hi. I'm Odysseas. I'm a master's student here. I would say, sort of adding to what the previous student said as well, I'd recall their ambassador, the leader leading the primary sort of group of this multilateral force. I'd recall their ambassador to my country, ask them what's going on, and if necessary, ask some more ambassadors to come and speak to me and try and figure out what's really going on behind the scenes. And if I'm still, you know, feeling that there's a lot of tension, I might have to provoke a response through a note verbal or something like that. Because if it's happening in my region, then obviously my security interests are at stake, and I think that would merit a response.
Anybody else? Please.
Hi, I'm Lucas. I'm an A-level student here in London. I guess, aside from what's already been said, if my country had the capabilities, I would suggest potentially, if it had come to this point, that my country conduct its own exercises or drills in the region to show that my country has the capability and sort of delegitimize what the coalition's claim, implicit claim that my country isn't capable or isn't needed in the coalition.
All of you, in my opinion, you are correct. You answered correctly. Although, as I said, there is no wrong and right in this situation. It's about identifying tools. You have to build a case. You have to have a case in order to go and protest and say why I'm not invited. And you must not be perceived as the student from UCL said, as a spoiler. This is really the essence of what you said. I mean, you have to have a case, a positive case, and you build this case not by saying, you know, that I'm close, geographic proximity only, because sometimes, you know, when I'm saying immediate neighbor can be, you know, there can be a country between the two, for instance, not immediate. Sometimes you have borders with them, you border with them as well. This means that you have to explain that as a responsible part member of the international community, you really promote stability and peace, and your intentions are good intentions. And you want to work with other partners within international organizations or within this initiative, this international initiative, in order to contribute to a solution. I mean, to have a peaceful solution, a diplomatic solution to the problem. For doing this, you have to make a strong case, in my opinion, not only, you know, saying, you know, generally, but, you know, my security is threatened, or you know, there will be a problem. Even sometimes migration and other arguments or cultural affiliations or these kind of things do not work. You have to have, first of all, stakes on the ground. This is something that really can help you out in this kind of situation. And in order to, and this can be benign as well, I mean, in the sense that you can be a humanitarian aid provider, for instance. And this can really help you in, for instance, international conference, they have conferences or efforts, they have a very strong humanitarian component. Think of what is happening to Gaza right now. I mean, there is a lot of questions and discussion about the humanitarian part of it, how you're going to dispatch humanitarian aid. If you are a country that participates in these efforts, and then there is an international conference on this, you will be not invited, but you have good chances to be included. And it's not only that, relations with both parties in the conflict. Don't think about this particular conflict again, any other conflict. Relations with parties in the conflict, relations, people-to-people relations, economic relations that can be still ongoing when there is a war, that is sometimes never stop. All these things are important. These are stakes. And you can use these stakes in order to make your case. And when you make your case, you have good chances. This is a way you can do, I mean, you can do other things as well. You can propose to host a conference, on this, or have meetings, organize meetings of the special envoys of other countries on this. You can do things that they can really put you in the game. And there are, of course, many, many, many other things that you can do. But you have to have a case. You have to be a responsible actor in international relations. And you have to win your participation and make them understand that in a recurrent, you know, diplomatic effort, you are somebody that you have to be in, you have to be part of it. For reasons also that, you know, can promote a peaceful, the chances, can increase the chances, your participation increases the chances of a peaceful solution. Another situation, another goal that I have mentioned is protection of human rights. Of course, when I describe the situation, you will definitely say that this is linked to Greece, but it can happen and happens to other countries as well. There are criticisms about the way your country has treated a group of migrants. And the UN launches an investigation to which your country has to respond. What tools would you use in this kind of situation? Please.
I think your tools are always limited as a diplomat if the national or domestic policy is against you. So the toolkit available to diplomats are always at hostage to the government's policies, especially if you work in the diplomatic field and you don't support whatever is happening in your country, it's very difficult to defend it. So an alignment with your government has to happen in order for you as a diplomat to work effectively.
I mean, it depends, obviously, on how severe the issue is and to what extent it's our own domestic policies' fault. For that, one needs to contextualize with friendly nations why something might have happened and be very solutions-oriented about it. Be honest, direct, and use the international community for support rather than debate.
We are recruiting interns in our embassy, so you might be interested because your answers are very, very good. And I really appreciate that we can have this discussion. Yes, indeed. First of all, as you said as well, you have to look at domestic policies. I mean, you have to start from what has happened. You have to talk to the relevant services. You have to again, make a case. But also, there are many other things that you can do. I mean, and you have to respond as a responsible actor. You have to provide evidence for your case. You have to respect the deadlines. You have to send to do whatever you have to do. But also, you, at the same time, and every moment, actually, you have to, before that and after that, you have to promote your main argument and main belief, actually, that in favor of the protection of human rights. I mean, at the international level, and when I'm talking international levels, usually it's Geneva, because Geneva is the center of the UN Center of Human Rights. You have to have very good, you have to good relations with the international organizations that are monitoring these kind of cases, and you have to be very close to them, and you have to be proactive as well. I mean, you have to organize different, let's say, events, side events, in the margins of the Human Rights Council of the UN, for instance, which is the main human rights organ of the UN. And you can also do things that, make a case that you are a country, a responsible country that promotes human rights, but of course, when there are accidents or there are things that you cannot control, of course, you explain why this has happened and you are open to that. I don't know if I should stop.
No, if you can continue for a while longer, then we'll just allow the audience to ask a general set
okay.
of questions. It might be useful, though, Ambassador, if you can actually give a few examples as you go along, because I think that will provoke
okay.
a few different kinds of questions as well.
Okay, thank you so much. Yes, this is a good one. The fourth one is upgrade the role of the country to the international system. Situation. Your country is a candidate for a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. Four candidates in your geographical group for two seats. This means that this is a competitive procedure, usually among partners and friends. What will be your strategy? Please.
My name is Ruth Hardy, and I'm a grad student here at LSE. I think primarily you would want to build a coalition of interests with your partners because you're in the same region, because, as you said, you have the same interests. I would assume that your political interests, especially within the Security Council, will somewhat align, and so by demonstrating that friendliness, if you will, by talking about the issues that others want represented, I think you could really put yourself up as a good candidate to represent yourself as well as your partners.
Please, have this, yes.
I mean, since these nations are sort of in the same region, I think probably the most important tool that you have in this scenario is your economic cooperation between your neighbors in that same region. So I'd try and see what you can do to improve that cooperation, to untangle any knots that might be in the way, or just kind of blocking any or creating any tension between you and your partners, to see if there are issues that you need to figure out before you get to the negotiating table for that Security Council seat.
Actually, you don't have to talk to the others. I mean, what you do in this kind of situation, you just promote your candidature. Again, you build your case professionally. You say what you want to do, in which parameters you're going to use, within which framework you are going to move if you are elected. And then leave the others do also what they have to do. If we're talking about stories and personal, let's say, situations that I have faced, I don't want to talk about the president because we are candidates for the UN Security Council, but this is a clean slate. I mean, two states for two seats, so there's no actual problem. But 20 years ago, we went to a small country in the southern Africa, a very small country, and we were competing with Canada and the Netherlands. And when we arrived there, the first thing that the Minister of Foreign Affairs showed to us was a picture of a school that was built by the Dutch. And the second thing that he had shown to us was actually a hospital built by the Canadians. So you can understand that, you know, our meeting lasted about 10 minutes. I mean, we just had to say, you know, the courtesy things that we usually say in this kind of situation. And we left. And we lost. And we lost big. Because we were not, you know, well prepared to face this kind of challenges. You can add up things to that. I mean, it's not about only, you know, humanitarian aid. It's not about presence in the country. It's about also, you know, common understandings. It's about relations that you have built over the years, and structural relations, economic relations, and other relations, cultural relations that you can do. And there are a lot of tools that you can really, really use in order to do that. For instance, pandemic was a tragedy. The an earthquake, it is a natural disaster. You can do things. There are opportunities always that come out for that. From that, I mean, see us with Turkey, for instance. I know that you want to hear this. After the earthquake that happened in Turkey, not only we came closer, and there is a dialogue now, a structured dialogue with different tools, political dialogue, confidence building measures, and many other things, a positive agenda, economic agenda that we are pursuing with them. But also we have been able for the first time to ensure an agreement that they are going to support us in one organization, I mean the UN Security Council, and we are going to support them in another one, which was the IMO here in London. This means that there are a lot of opportunities which emerge all the time, and you can really use these opportunities and these tools. For instance, we wanted, you know, to expand a little bit our relations with African countries and other countries, Asian countries. After COVID, we had available about, I don't know the exact number, 7 million doses of vaccine. We used that in order to go and see countries that we have never seen in the past. But of course, also we have, and these are potential voters also for, you know, UN Security Council, but not only that. In the meantime, you build relations that are useful. And you use this opportunity in order to create, you know, a common understanding. We wanted to go, for instance, to Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast, we needed to discuss with them. And we realized that we didn't have any kind of relation with this country. I mean, very rare contacts here and there. And we decided to try to see how we can approach a country like this. First of all, you build common understanding. There are commonalities in our relation with this particular country, the way we view some things. For instance, maritime security. They have a problem with maritime security. International law of the sea. They interpret the law of the sea the same way that we do. We have other common affiliations. Francophonie. We are part of the Francophonie. We have excellent relations with France. France is the is a key strategic partner of ours, and they are a Francophone country. So we opened also an embassy near Côte d'Ivoire. It could not be, I mean, you cannot open an embassy everywhere. We did it in Senegal. And I'm proud to say that today in this audience, there is somebody who was part of our embassy in Senegal. And I met her now, Mrs. Glinyadakis, when I went to Senegal with the minister in order to inaugurate the embassy. She was there, and she was one of the, and now she's working for this prestigious institution. She left us, actually, not because, I don't think she did it because she went to Senegal, but now she's not with us anymore, but she's with you. And they have done an excellent job, and they took up the challenge, and there were only three people at the beginning. They opened this embassy, and they started to establish relations with all countries around, Francophone countries of West Africa. And these are very important countries because, for all the reasons that I have already explained to you, but also because these countries can, with the relations you are building, and with the tools you are using, they are also, in the international context, can be useful to you. I mean, they can vote for you. They know who you are, actually. And if they know who you are, they can be close to you in different situations that you cannot imagine. I was in some countries that we don't have relations, they still rely, you know, on our ancient history. I was lobbying for, in the Human Rights Council in Geneva, I was lobbying for Greece because there was an examination of Greece. It's called the UPR, a review of Greece in the human rights area. And then, you know, we were talking to countries, to friendly countries, saying, you know, don't be very harsh on us because, you know, we have done this, we have done the other, we have done other things. And, of course, I lobbied, you know, from 140 countries, we have lobbied our team, I don't know, 100. And suddenly, I have seen that the representative of Malawi took the floor. And he started talking about Greece like Greece was his country of origin. I mean, he said about, you know, the Parthenon marbles, about Aristotle, about Plato, about... He was talking about, the time frame was 2 minutes. He was talking about 6 minutes. I've never seen this guy before. And then I went to talk to him. I said, how do you know my country? I have read books, he said. I don't know you. Why you don't come to see us? And we can provide to you, you know, material, if you like so much our country. And then we became friends. But sometimes, you don't need to do that. You don't need to expect that people, you know, to go back 2,500 years in order to say a good word for your country. You have to build it, and you do it, and you have to build it every day. So I will stop here. There are other questions. I think we don't have time for that. But I would like, since we are in Africa, use a final example, and we are talking about examples now from professional career, a final example about situations that are in a way useful in meeting at the same time different goals. I mean, not only one. I can give you an example. Niger. I don't know if you know this country. Niger is one of the poorest countries in the world. There is a problem with arms smuggling, illegal migration. At the time we went there, I mean, 2 years ago. And at that time was the only stable country in the area. And we had to approach, as member of the European Union, to approach this country. We needed their vote, but also we wanted to establish relations with them and also to finance programs that would keep people in the country and not, you know, make them potential migrants from Libya and onwards. And we went there, so this, you know, is protection of human rights, these are other things that that other goals that have been served at the same time. Also, we wanted to promote, as I said, the candidature, which falls within the upgrade of the role of the country, which is another goal, and economic diplomacy. We wanted to promote investment with this country, ties with the EU, because there was an EU mission there which we have visited, which helped them reform the security sector of the country in order to counter security and other threats. We promoted sports diplomacy, which were quite famous on that. We have like a branded diplomatic brand name on that. We financed the Confederation of Women Football there. And we tried, you know, to and of course nobody from Greece has never been to this country. And we have tried, you know, with one example, with one move, try to do different things, and as we do in all countries that we were trying to approach. Of course, at the end there was a coup d'etat. Everything is finished. I mean, there is nothing from what we have tried to do now there. But there is always the good time. There is always the right time to do that. And being a good diplomat is that means that you have to make sure that your toolbox, the one I'm trying to describe to you that exists, is always full of ideas, full of potential projects, promoting win-win solutions. These solutions, at the end of the day, despite changes, are bringing countries together and make the world a better place. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can I bring my papers?
Yes, please come and join me here. We have a good half an hour for a discussion. If I may just abuse the position of chairing this meeting to make one point and perhaps ask you a couple of questions, and then we'll open it up to further discussion. It seems to me that a lot of what you've said, and from my own professional experience, somebody who's interested in understanding and teaching foreign policy, it seems to me that a lot of what you do as a diplomat, or what diplomacy is trying to achieve, is to change perceptions, but to change perceptions through a rational way. Many of the four scenarios that you painted all start with the proposition of, to deal with this particular scenario, you have to have information, and you have to share that information. And that information has to serve the purpose of clarifying issues, as well as making your own case. Now, having said that, my first question to you is, has the role of the diplomat changed? We live in a world of information flows, which are not subjected simply to information gathering by Ambassador Tawusi's in London. Diplomats and foreign policymakers at home are bombarded with information. In the 21st century, what is the role of the diplomat in that respect? How do you manage to harness information and then translate it in a rational way which makes the case that you want to make? Because everybody's got access to this information. That's the first point. I'll just make, if I could just ask another question and then allow you to answer that. The second question is a nasty question, and perhaps one that you may want to avoid answering for the time being, but I'll force you to come back to it later. What is a friendly country? At least two of the goals that you outlined made mention of a friendly country. Now, a friendly country could be a country that is like-minded, It could be a country that is a partner in an institution but is not necessarily a friendly country, but it is part of the same institutional structure, an alliance or a union. It could be a country that is a friendly country in the long term, but in the short term is undergoing some kind of political upheaval or a particular regime that's in power that's not necessarily friendly. When does a friendly country stop being friendly? Or when does an unfriendly country become friendly? I could force you to name names and give us examples, but I leave that up to you.
Well, let's start from the difficult part with the second question. Friendly, I avoided, for the reason you have explained, I avoided to use the word friendly alone. I was using the word friendly slash partner country. I didn't want to indicate, you know, to which organization, but you could understand that this kind of discussions usually, I mean, on political issues, you do it with very, very close countries to you, and the EU is one situation where you do that. Of course, you are not implying the EU, which is like a playground in the sense that, you know, there is a community of values for many, many years, and it's like families, you know, you have arguments, but at the end of the day, there is consensus on many, many issues, and you build this supranational relation that, you know, keeps going, and this is the most successful experiment after 1945. And we have all, of course, I'm in the UK, and I'm saying this, but as a European diplomat, I would say that there is a value in the EU, and the relations you build within the EU are true relations and are relations that you will keep, and they will be stronger and stronger, in my opinion. But sometimes you have to, in order to achieve, you know, a goal within the EU, you have to you are neglecting sometimes bilateral relations with the partner countries, and this is actually what we did. We tried, and this is what the country is doing. We are trying to not forget that there is always this bilateral aspect of relations, and we are trying to nurture it. With visits, with agreements, with bilateral agreements, with things that can really make our multilateral relation within the EU and other organizations strong and like building a community. So there is this type of friendship, which is a strong friendship, a partnership, and of course there are based on values, in my opinion, of course, on interests, 100%, there is no discussion about that. But the working methods usually lead to an outcome accepted by the consensus, accepted by all. Of course, there are other situations, alliances, maybe you're implying NATO, for instance, that you don't find this kind of always. But then it's about the nature of the organization is different, does not cover, you know, all the aspects like the EU does. And of course, when you have to do or to talk about, you know, defense, security, sometimes, you know, the interests of the countries do not converge very, very easily. And there are situations where you might see a difference of opinion or a conflict or a divide, let's say, within such an organization. That's why, for instance, NATO has adopted the Lund's ruling since 1982, that keeping, you know, difference like that away. And this is something that you know can really ease some situations. When friendship, I mean, when we're talking about diplomatic friendship and friendship between countries, it's not the same as we understand it anyway between, you know, individuals, because between humans. It's something different, like the friends in Facebook who are not real friends, or in Instagram. They're not always real friends. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. So there is also this element we have to keep in mind. Oof, the easiest one now, information. Information, you know, sometimes we feel like working in the stock exchange. It's not, we're getting, as you say, a lot of information. I don't have my mobile with me, but I can show it to you. I mean, we are connected with a lot of news agencies, especially now that we have, you know, a lot of crises around us, which affect our own countries, but also, you know, the EU and other countries, and the whole world, actually, regionally and internationally. And you have to be quick in reacting. For instance, today I was in a meeting, the German ambassador had the courtesy to invite us with the presence of the Palestinian ambassador. And we were there discussing, and you know, there were things happening as we were talking. Also, last night, you have to wake up half an hour early to see what has happened, and then to be able to react in case somebody, and not to be embarrassed also, because most of them, they know already in real time what is happening. Like the Red Sea, now I have my colleague with me, that she's connected with a UK military service, which in real time reports what is happening in the Red Sea, if there is an attack, and she's getting alerts. I don't know if you have got alerts now, as we speak. And if there is something, you know, because this is a British, let's say, service, military service, we have our own responsibility. Of course, it goes through directly, but we have our own responsibility to be sure that, you know, Athens is informed about that. And we do that. And we do that all the time. It's not, sometimes it's practical. It's not practical because we have to be around all day. And be sure that you have your mobile with you. But it can be also very important, you know, for your work and what you do in order to achieve the goals. And
okay, thank you very much. Let's take some questions. The gentleman there.
Thank you.
We'll take two or three questions and then we'll come back.
Sure. Thank you, Ambassador, for your presence here. I'm Apostolos Valassas. I'm working for a UK government energy agency, former student of the London School of Economics. I wanted to ask you about the second example you mentioned before on the case where a country is excluded from an international conference for a regional crisis. And I assume you had Libya in your mind, and Greece is, perhaps, I assume.
What, Libya?
Libya, yes.
I will tell you.
And Greece's exclusion from the international conference back then. My question is, how can a country avoid such exclusions, such situations? So I know that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs took some actions to rectify the situation. That's the reactive part, but we need to talk about the preemptive part. And in this case, was the fact that Greece wasn't adequately prepared, there was a lack of information, or was it the fact that there was some perhaps deliberate bias from the side of our partners? Yes, and perhaps, again, a more general answer on how we avoid such mistakes and omissions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. There was another hand. Yes.
Thank you very much for your lecture. I'm Kalitos, I'm from UCL. Perhaps the conclusion that I've made from this lecture is that successful diplomacy comes from building a case on rationality and information. My question had two parts, but I believe that Dr. Economidis raised the first part on information. So I would like to ask, what happens when we can't really build a case on rationality and whereas our partners are irrational? Let's take an example of a conflict. For example, Niger, as you've mentioned before, where we had a coup d'etat, so we don't really have any rationality or any proper information in building our case and building partnerships.
And one last question, just here.
Thank you. My name is Toju. I am a master's student here at LSE. So my question is more of a personal question. Not really personal, but just I'm interested in like the day-to-day of being a diplomat. Because you mentioned at a certain point you were in about 90 countries, and also like the constant messages. I mean, wars and conflicts don't stop because you are sleeping or because it's night here, but it's probably, I don't know, day in Australia. So you still have to be informed about what's happening all over the world. So how does that work? Like, when do you have time to, I don't know, it seems very hectic and very, to always be, I don't know, plugged in. How's that?
Okay, so we have three different questions. The first is essentially about Libya, using that as an example. The second question is about irrationality and whether we can make rational decisions or whether certain aspects are just impossible to be rational about. And the third question is really to do about your day-to-day diplomacy and when you were working with the foreign minister on a personal level and you traveled so extensively and had to deal with so many different kinds of issues, how the hell do you keep control of what you're supposed to be discussing, where and when?
Okay. The first one, no, it was not about Libya. It could be about Libya, it could be about Syria, it could be about the Middle East, it could be about other countries, not Greece. But I will not avoid to answer the question as far as Libya is concerned, in the sense that, we had a difficult triangular relations with Libya, but it's not true that we were excluded, I mean, from international conference. We have participated to some others, not. But now I understand that we, as the other student said, we have built our case, and we are there. And we are there not only in Libya, we are there in Syria, we are there in the Middle East. We are a reliable partner. Our minister has been recently to the region several times. He is discussing and trying to find solutions on many different issues that arise within the European Union, bilaterally with the countries affected, and our diplomacy is very much an energetic diplomacy, and it's a diplomacy that brings us in actually by initiative of others, not by our own initiative. Now sometimes it starts to become automatic, you know, that Greece should be there, because Greece is now it has been, but is now even more a reliable partner and a country that really bases its policies on principles and on international law. And this is something that, you know, it is now well understood and well taught by our political leadership. And we had our minister actually here in LSE two months ago, I think, and he made exactly this case that we are a country that a very reliable interlocutor, and also a country that has ideas and has the means and has the alliances in the region and beyond the region to promote constructive solutions to the problems. And a country that does not have really problems with the neighbors. It's a country that we have ties with all our neighborhood, despite the fact that our neighborhood is turbulent. And about rationality and irrationality, I mean, when things are irrational in the sense that, you know, democracy is not working, there are problems, what do you do actually? I mean, you rely on the mechanisms that have been set up after the Second World War. This is our system, our UN system. I mean, the Security Council is taking decisions to confront with these kinds of situations. The countries are contributing to those decisions. If you need to have a peacekeeping operation or to have any kind of other intervention, there is a framework and there are rules. But if are violated, the international community and there are courts, there is international justice as well, the international criminal justice as well, that you know are in place and luckily so that you know can redress these kind of situations if they are dangerous to the security, the regional security and world security, and then you know create an environment when bilateral relations and regional relations can flourish again. And about myself, you should ask the guy that is sitting behind you. He's my son, actually. And family is very important, I would say. Family is always important because they have to tolerate what you're doing, and they have done not only that, but they have been very, very supportive until the moment that he became a student in London, and he said to me, "You must stop this now, and you will come to London." And it was already 4 years that I could not see him very often, and I did what he said. I stopped this and I came to London. And I'm very happy to have been with you today. Spiros,
thank you
so much.
There's a few more questions.
Ah, sorry.
No, we haven't finished yet. You can't leave yet. You can't leave yet.
Yeah, I'm very
Please.
Happy. I'm very happy.
Thank you. Dimitrios Kavouras, Chatham House Fellow. Your Excellency, while you were in office heading the diplomatic office of the foreign minister, there were a lot of tripartite cooperation between Cyprus and Egypt and Cyprus and Israel on mainly energy cooperation, trying to create Greece as an energy hub. But following Russia's invasion in Ukraine, that was more sort of priority for the EU's energy security. And can energy cooperation, do you believe that can energy cooperation contribute to the peaceful and more prosperous Eastern Mediterranean region, given that we have currently Gaza's war, a frozen conflict in Cyprus, and Turkish dispute on the Greek and the Cypriot exclusive economic zones. Thank you.
Thank you. And Vasilis.
Thank you, Ambassador. I have to say I didn't expect to see a list of 10 goals, and especially the number 10. But can I ask, are these goals seen as kind of lexicographic, that, you know, number one is the main goal and then subject to attaining one, you get to the second goal, and so forth? So is it like a ranking of priorities in any sense? And also, are they seen as, if you want, separable, independent? On the lexicographic, on the first, if they're ranked, I want to ask then, if so, yet then who decides and how that changes perhaps with the shifts in politics in the country over time? But also on the separable, in your own examples, you were saying, I don't remember now which country it is, country C sells, or country B sells weapons to country C, then we can, use our direct diplomacy, but also we can use you know, invest in economic interests that we have in country C, and so forth. So of course you use, you know, you promote the business interests or interests of specific businesses, not only the economic interests, but also specific businesses, in order to support your the leverage, the influence you have on other countries. You may even, you know, exploit diaspora that you have there, or friendly senators or MPs that you have in the other countries. So there's all tools of cultural, economic, and other types of diplomacy. But then the promoting the business or the economic interests of the country was, I think, goal number 7, and the business interests of particular sectors was goal number 9. Although both things seem to be relevant for goal number 1, how to deal with, you know, a situation that you want to avoid about being threatened by a third country. So are they ordered? Are they seen as separable? Does it make sense to be ordered? Does it make sense to be seen as separable?
Okay, I'm going to take 2 more questions. We've got a lot of hands, but we'll take 1 more question now, and then we'll come back for another round if we can keep you just for a few more minutes.
Hello, so I'm a former alumni from master's course. As previously discussed, diplomacy is about making a case based on information and evidence. Do you think the diplomat's role is to leverage evidence in a political way to advance one's country's interests? And maybe a slightly more sticky question, in terms of diplomacy, was it a mistake for the Greek Prime Minister to bring up the marbles when he visited the UK?
Okay, there are a number of other people who want to ask questions, but let's try and answer these. Ambassador, feel free to answer whichever parts of the question you want to, because we are running out of time. So, energy cooperation, the Eastern Mediterranean, it's a very important part of Greek diplomacy, and especially, you were especially involved in the last 5 years in a lot of what was happening in the Eastern Mediterranean in terms of Greek diplomacy. So that's question one. Question two, Vasilis's question was a combination of who sets goals, political leadership, the sequencing of goals. I mean, do we do all of these things all the time? And the last question was about the marbles, essentially.
About trilateral cooperation, I want to tell you that this is not only cooperation in energy. Trilateral cooperation with Israel, with Egypt, and occasionally there are other countries involved in plus one schemes, like the US, for instance, in the cooperation with Israel, or France in our cooperation with Egypt, sometimes and other countries as well, in the past the Emirates and other countries of the region. These are about you know, building common understandings, working together in different sectors, and not only energy, economy as well, as has been mentioned, and also, you know, many different parts, agriculture with Egypt. There are a lot of projects, because these relations are not have not been you know, developed now. I mean, I think the trilateral with Egypt and Israel are already 10 years now, or even more. So these are strong partnerships that are referred to many different sectors across the board. Of course, energy is important, and of course, energy security is a very topical issue. And of course, you know, our efforts in the area, in Cyprus' efforts as well, are efforts that you know, became even more important now when the Russian invasion happened, and the problem of energy security was not, you know, local anymore, or the issue of energy security and connecting, you know, north of the south became urgent, because there was a lack of supply in Europe as a whole. In Europe was facing some problems. Of course, cooperation is the key word, and this is not only about states being involved. You know, there are institutions like the EU. There are, of course, a lot of private actors. You know, the trilaterals and other cooperation between states, you know, provide, in a way, the umbrella, so that this kind of private and cooperations with the involvement of international organization can really flourish. The other one was about the goals. Yes, of course, you have to do everything at the same time. I mean, there is no real hierarchy. And as I said, and when I used the example about Niger, what you do in one instance, for example, can meet several goals at the same time. For instance, I mentioned that, you know, when you finance a project of an international organization, let's say in Libya now, change, not Niger, let's say Libya, the student has left. But yes, it can be, for instance, in helping international organizations to deal with the problems of IDPs, internally displaced persons, or refugees as well. You can do that through, you know, an international organization. And this is also something that, you know, meets several goals at the same time. For instance, we have done that in Libya. We have adopted, we have sponsored a team, a football team, actually, there, made of IDPs and refugees. And then you protect their human rights, and then you also promote, you know, your goals, your international goals that you promote also in the international organization, because we have taken a lot of, initiatives in this area of sports diplomacy, like the protection of journalists and other areas, thematic areas, which Greece is promoting in the international organization. And of course, business. I don't know. I don't have time to mention the other goals. But as you said, the other goals were about business and economic diplomacy. You know, I don't agree with people saying that we have the political diplomacy and the economic diplomacy. Diplomacy is one, and these things are intertwined, are interlinked. I mean, you promote goals of any diplomacy by using tools of the so-called other diplomacy. And you do that because, at the end of the day, diplomacy is one. And the goals are common goals. Whether you can use these tools, economic tools or political tools, in order to achieve your goals, at the end of the day, it's not, in a way, relevant. The important is to achieve the common goals that diplomacy every country should serve. I missed.
There was one question up there. The person asked the question. The second half of the question was about the marbles.
The marbles.
At the top, the left there. The first half of the question was more about evidence and how you use evidence, if I understood it correctly. Anyway, answer whichever bits of the question you'd like to answer.
About the marbles. When you have a prime minister that comes here in this country and gives an interview and then makes a public statement, a diplomat has nothing to say. I mean, in the sense that we all align behind our prime minister. As persons, we are also proud of what he said and what he did. But this is personal, not professional. And we believe that this dispute, this issue, I don't want to call it dispute, should be sorted out through the negotiations that are already ongoing. And whatever we do and we say on this matter, we have to be sure that it's more in the sense of raising awareness rather than, you know, interfering with negotiations and create, understandings and misperceptions about Greece's position during this negotiation. But the issue is there, and as an embassy, we are here to continue raising awareness on that, and when you have the chance that the Prime Minister does this for you, you're a lucky ambassador.
Thank you very much. I know there are people who want to ask questions, but could I ask you to hold on to those questions? And can I invite you to a little reception we're going to have outside? And perhaps you can ask the ambassador directly in person your questions, so we don't keep everybody here who doesn't want to be here. So please do come and join us for a reception. No, I'm not finished yet. Please, wait. Do come and join us for a reception. If you enjoy the reception and you like the wine that we're going to offer you or the soft drinks we're going to offer you, then please come back to our future events. I'd just like to make a couple of announcements. On Tuesday, 13th of February, Archbishop Nikitas of Thyatira in Great Britain will be giving a public lecture on behalf of the Hellenic Observatory, talking about, does Europe need religion? You can find the details on our website. And on Tuesday, the 14th of March, we've got the Governor of the Bank of Greece, Yanis Tournaras, who will also be giving a public lecture. There are a series of other seminars that the Hellenic Observatory is putting on, and you can find those on the relevant website. Now I'm going to let you go, but before I do that, I'd like to thank the ambassador very, very much and also offer him a small token of our appreciation for coming and sharing his thoughts with us tonight.
Thank you so much. Thank you.